Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Europa, I'm feeling very excited. It's time for Must Have Seen TV, the podcast dedicated to the sitcoms of the 20th century from I Love Lucy to News Radio. I'm your TV guy, Brett White, and I'm also a senior reporter producer for Decider.com. And as you can tell by that RuPaul quote, actually Pearl as Big Ange, we're in Pride Month territory now, which means we're going to be talking about a gay episode of a straight sitcom from before Ellen came out of the closet. And this week I have joining me the co-host of This Had Oscar Buzz, Chris File. Hi, Chris.
Hi. Okay, this is maybe, I mean, technically, this is a straight sitcom.
Yes. Yeah.
Technically.
There are no canonical homosexuals amongst the show. But
right.
The gays love this show. The gays see themselves in this show. But yeah, so let's start off with the general chit chat. Okay, tell the listeners about your very gay podcast that you have yourself.
Yeah,
because it's pretty gay. It's a pretty gay topic.
It's two gay men pontificating about actresses and trophies for actresses and trophies for movies and such. Yeah, I co-host This Had Oscar Buzz with Joe Reed. We do not talk about movies that won Oscars. We do not talk about movies that were nominated for Oscars. We talk about movies that were either predicted or positioned or campaigned for, like movie award season, Oscars, and then received no nomination. So forgotten things such as we're doing a whole mini series on Focus Features right now as of recording. Our most recent episode that dropped was Less Caution. We've also done movies that are more punchlines, like the Jennifer Aniston movie Cake. We have done Cats. We have done such gay movies as Roland Emmerich's abysmal abomination, oof, Stonewall.
Yeah. Yes.
Yeah, we have a good time, but we talk about more than just the movie. We talk about like awards ethos itself. We talk about pop culture. We obviously talk about like actors and actresses we love. It's a time. We have a good time.
So, are there any what is a 2021 movie that you foresee being future fodder that you think is definitely getting buzz, but you don't think it's going to get nominated for nothing?
We will definitely see, and it feels like those wheels are just beginning to start. Like, I think a lot of people are looking at In the Heights, and I can imagine that will go the distance. But maybe one that I'm looking forward to probably most that could really go in either direction, and I could really see it bottoming out hard, is Michael Showalter's Eyes of Tammy Faye.
Oh, yeah.
I'm so excited for this movie just because, Jessica Chastain is playing Tammy Faye for Michael Showalter.
Oh, my God.
So it's going to be very specific. Andrew Garfield is going to play Jim Baker. It could be a real mess, but it could also be very good. So that's maybe one that I could see that way.
That is exciting.
There's always things on the horizon. Like Ridley Scott has two whole movies coming out this year, one of which is like an ancient war epic starring Ben Affleck and Matt Damon that's also co-written by Nicole Holofcener. And then there's the Gucci movie, which, like, again, that's movie that could go anyway.
Wow, this is a big year. I mean, what about Fast 9?
Oh, definitely not. There's no way. There's just no way. No way.
Because it's going to get nominated for something. Honestly, it could get a special effects or sound design or something.
Listen, if it makes more money than anything else, who knows?
Who cares?
But, you know? Yeah.
Before we get into it, listeners, I'm going to keep haranguing y'all because there are 5 Wednesdays in June. I'm trying to do 4 Pride Month episodes, but then I have this 5th. Vestigial Wednesday hanging around on June 30th. And since it's the year anniversary of my Hayden Rourke biography episode that I did last June, I would like to do a Hayden Rourke Q&A. I literally just thought of that. Probably ain't going to work. Q&A. If anyone has any questions about my year-long research and deep dive into the annals of gay history and I Dream of Jeannie and Hayden Rourke and my talks with Ed Asner, Barbara Eden, the children of Larry Hagman and Bill Daly. It's been a roller coaster of a year, people. So you can email musthaveseentv@gmail.com or at me on Twitter. And maybe if there's enough questions, I will do a mail episode. And if not, you'll know I didn't get any questions because there won't be an episode and it will be embarrassing in retrospect. But anyway, this is me always begging for validation and et cetera. But anyway, this week we are traveling to October 5th, 1987. Fatal Attraction ruled the box office. Here I Go Again by Whitesnake topped the charts, and CBS aired the Designing Women episode, Killing All the Right People. Chris, you must have seen Killing All the Right People before today.
Have.
Yes.
Designing Women was definitely one of those early shows for me, like in the 2-hour syndication block at like dinner time.
Yes.
It was one of the early ones before like Friends and Frasier hit syndication and it bumped those shows off. Like there's always a certain food chain for like the syndication, or at least there was when I was a younger
kid. That doesn't exist anymore. Well, I mean, I guess
no,
kids know
syndication
it
isn't real.
Yeah, God. Because like, for me, it was like when dinner comes, it was always like Simpsons, Home Improvement, Seinfeld, and then like Frasier or Mad About You. Like it was always in that kind of realm. Or you go on Lifetime and they're just playing Golden Girls 24 hours a day. And then Designing Women later, I think.
Yeah, but like this is the era when it was still too recent for any of those shows to be on TV land.
Yes, yeah.
So it's a very like specific time, like full disclosure. I apologize. I would have been a very newborn baby when this episode aired.
I mean, I would have been 3. So
yeah. You too were a baby.
Yeah.
This is a show that occupies a certain time in my life where I was like, becoming aware of television, and like I don't have a memory of actually seeing this episode until much, much later and like in adulthood. And like this is, you know, obviously a very like classic, much discussed like gay episode of television where it's like even if you aren't, you know, doing, everybody's rewatching The Nanny now, so it's like even if you're not doing a rewatch of a certain show, that you'll jump back to just watch that episode because people talk about it.
I mean, this is iconic. I think that this comes a couple years before Golden Girls. They had an AIDS episode, I don't know, 88 or 89, where Rose thinks she might have AIDS for 72 hours.
Yeah.
Which is, there are like 3 phases of Golden Girls. It's like the first couple seasons are like just very good, great classic comedy. And then the middle is like all of a sudden there are a lot of issues that they're tackling, like elderly homelessness and like Reaganomics and stuff, but still funny. And then the end of it is just like Mitchell Hurwitz gets involved and it's just kooky bananas and it's also great. So they, of course, did an AIDS episode, but Designing Women, for some reason, Golden Girls' sworn enemy got to it first. There was a weird feud between those shows.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, I think it was only one-sided. I think Golden Girls did not like Designing Women, but Designing Women did not care, I think.
Well, yeah, because Golden Girls was way more appreciated. I mean, like, Designing Women wasn't a chump in the ratings. Like, it was a show that did well, but, like, they didn't win, like, Emmys for this show, whereas, like, Golden Girls was what it was.
All 4 of them, yeah.
Yeah. So that's actually interesting to hear. I didn't know that there was a rivalry of sorts between the 2 shows.
Yeah, like the showrunners of Golden Girls just kind of shittily thought that Designing Women just stole, like they were like, what, another show with 4 women? How, like, you know, as if they had invented that, which is kind of like, that's weird. Like, you should want more all-female casts on television.
Right. It's also like five women, kind of.
Yeah, and then there's also Meshach Taylor is hanging around, and then there's there's the old, was it Alice Ghostly? Is that who that is? Yes.
Yes.
Yes, yeah. Bewitched. So this week on Must Have Seen TV, we're going to be talking about the Designing Women episode, Killing All the Right People. It is the fourth episode of season two, and it was written by Linda Bloodworth-Thomason, as is most every episode at this point, and directed by Harry Thomason. Here's how Hulu describes the episode. A wonderful young friend enlists the Sugar Baker firm's services for an unusual project. He is dying of AIDS and wants them to design his funeral, and Mary Jo becomes involved in a PTA debate over sexually active school students. Chris, how accurate is that description?
It's pretty accurate. Made more accurate through dialect.
I realized halfway through that my kind of flippant, silly accent, which is, I'm from Tennessee, it's genuine, was maybe not appropriate for a wonderful young man with AIDS asking him to plan a funeral. But
I mean, like, it's still a lighthearted show, so it's like, there's some of it where it's like, you know, you can tell that they have, like, a very special episode in mind. But still kind of are treading the taste level in a way to still make it a lighthearted, silly show in a way that, like, maybe it shows the strings of that effort a little bit more by today's standards. You know, maybe we would be able to walk a finer line a little bit now. But it's more that it kind of leans into, like, its intention of being this, like, very important one-off episode.
So the genesis of this episode comes from Linda Bloodworth-Thomason's mother contracted HIV and then AIDS through a blood transfusion. And when she was in the hospital, basically, like, sitting while watching her mother die, she, of course, also saw just a lot of other gay men in the hospital and got to know a lot of them, and also got to overhear nurses talking about how disgusted they were with all of it, including one of them saying, literally, at least it's killing all the right people. And that is where the title of this episode comes from. So, knowing that background, which I do not believe... I did research with newspapers.com to, like, check out what the... talk was in the leading up to this episode, like, how they marketed it, and they did not mention, they just basically said, like, it's an AIDS episode that demystifies it and, like, clarifies myths, but they didn't mention the very personal aspect that is kind of key to understanding why this episode pulls no punches.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely, because that exact line is given to the villain of the episode, right?
Imogene, straight up
Imogene.
Bitch. Horrible. Yeah. Don't like her. But you know what else doesn't pull any punches? The opening credits.
No. The perfect opening credits.
I mean, the vibe of the opening credits. How would you describe the vibe of those opening credits?
Very professional glamour shots. You know, you get the multiple poses of each actress in her frame, with, of course, the corny theme music that is so wonderful and fabulous.
God, it's just so... It is, like, being from Tennessee, this show represents a kind of South that I wish actually existed. Southern Democrats! Oh, God. Am I... Anyway, I know y'all are out there and you're fighting the good fight. Thank you so much. I ran away to New York, and am I a coward? Maybe. Anyway, the episode. Well,
it's also a very specific Southern Democrat, because these are Clinton Democrats. These are late 80s Clinton Democrats. Very specific Southern demographic.
And we're going to get to some things, some conversations that come up that are nowadays just like, that's weird. But the episode starts with Delta Burke. Suzanne is complaining about how Imogene, the episode's villain, is over there bragging about her kid to Julia, because that's just like what she does. She always has to, like, one up. I did like that Suzanne mentioned Vanderbilt. Like, if Julia's son's going to Vanderbilt, her son has to as well. Because, like, if you're from Tennessee or the South, Vanderbilt is our version of the Ivy League.
Mm-hmm.
And I, being from Tennessee, I know nothing about Ivy League schools. That's just my jam. And in order to, like, make Imogen just, like, placate her because it's her birthday, Julia just says, like, oh, Payne's flunking chemistry.
Yeah.
Just to
yeah.
make her feel good.
And to get her out the door, too, so that she doesn't have to have some jockeying thing yeah. back and forth with this woman.
Because she is awful. We don't...
Yeah.
Yeah. Imogen's horrible. She's
even dress her in comparison to the rest of the women, too, because mm-hmm. they're all in, like, pastels and light colors, and then yes. she's in brown.
Yeah, she's, like, at the end, she's in head-to-toe brown, wearing almost like an army helmet kind of, like, Sunday hat kind
yeah.
of. Like, it's so rigid. It's
well, and she even has, like, the brooch pinning the fabric up, too, so it almost looks like a military-style badge, too.
Oh, wow, she's militant. She's militant yeah. about her beliefs. Wow, that's actually costume designer. Good job. This is where Julia then mentions that... So, this is one of those things... Sitcoms of the 80s are not structured the way that we are taught to think about sitcoms in the 90s and modern of, like, the ABC storyline. The sitcoms like Designing Women, Golden Girls did this very well. Like, they would have very clear A, B, sometimes C storyline. It was very clear. Designing Women is, it's written more like a one-act play where there are asides that don't have payoffs. They are not a plot. They're just characters talking about random things. And so, like, Julia talks about, like, her mom is away, so she's taking care of Mrs. Clifton, who is the, like, baddie, like, older lady, and they're going to the symphony. We never see the symphony. It is not a plot point. but they talk about it for a bit.
But it does really kind of fill out, like, our idea of what this world is that
yeah.
they occupy and, like, their social circle, because, like, there's only even, like, two sets in this episode, right? There's
yeah.
the school classroom, and then there's the main set, their house.
Man,
right?
What a but cheap, like, well, nice, good show to just crank them out. Budget always always under budget. Even one of the reviews, one of the, like, preview pieces that I found written about this episode actually points out, like, every Designing Women episode has a structure. It opens up with all them just talking about random stuff, and then it gets into, like, the preachy part. It was a good write-up, but it did point out the very obvious formula. Mm-hmm. Then we get Charlene, played by Jean Smart, who I do feel like we have to have a side note to just talk about the renaissance, the Jean Smartissance that we are in 2021.
It's so interesting watching her in this show where she, it's not quite the airhead of other sitcoms.
Mm-hmm.
You know, she's not a Phoebe Buffay.
No, she's
airhead,
not a, she's not, like, a Rose. No.
But she is, like, the ditz of
mm-hmm.
the group, right? And it's so interesting to see that it, like, in retrospect, that is Jean Smart, because, like, Jean Smart now is just defined by, like, grizzled competence.
Oh my
now.
God. Her in Watchmen is so wild to think about Charlene holding a big blue dildo and that not being funny, like that actually being a dramatic, serious moment that you're like, this is art.
Charlene might have been proud.
Yeah. But like Hacks and Mayor of Easttown, she's in both of these mm-hmm. shows at the same time.
Doing two, like, giving two quintessential Jean Smart performances, but also in very, very different
yeah.
characters, too, who get
yes.
a whole different range of elements to play. I mean, she's the actual star of Hacks, so that's one thing. But, like,
yeah.
Probably my favorite side bit that, like, all of Mare of Easttown, for the most part, is just, like, local color. It's just,
mm-hmm.
like... character density. But my favorite thing about the show is, like, she really just wants to be left alone so she can have some snacks, and I find it very relatable.
Yeah, that's definitely a mood for 2021. I mean, speaking of snacks, Charlene comes in talking about the mini marts that she was at because it took forever to get through the line, where she does have a line that is sort of like
very 80s sitcom.
Have you noticed how all mini marts are either being taken over by Middle Eastern people or teenagers? All the cashiers are either named Abdul or Kevin. Which is
does not hold up.
Doesn't
not
age
good.
Well. I mean, yeah, definitely doesn't. I don't like. I would actually. Like, what is the crest of the stereotype of Middle Eastern people being cashiers at gas stations? Like, is this actually at the bottom of it? Like, it's starting, so therefore at the time it was kind of, like, cutting edge? Or was it already hacky then? Like, it's...
I mean, it doesn't get the biggest laugh from the studio audience.
No. And then they also just kind of just, like, move along. Like, they don't... Yeah. Again, it is not a plot point. Her, like, grudge against either Abdul or Kevin is not... Or Abdul and Kevin. Maybe they're both working at the Quickie Mart. It's not a plot point. So,
it's this weird half joke because, like, the idea that all teenagers are named Kevin is funny.
Yeah.
But then it's sandwiched in between racist humor.
Yeah. That definitely does not age well. And then we go right into what Anthony is doing, Meshack Taylor. He's, like... borrowing a bunch of communication equipment to go work, like, to, like, what, film football games? And he, to inspire kids to get out of the ghetto or something? Like, what?
Yeah.
So again, like, these two things back to back was kind of like, oh god, this is very 1987.
Yeah.
Well, and what, again, I'm gonna keep talking about this interview this review. They actually pointed out, the kind of, and this is 1987, they pointed out that Anthony is a weird, dicey character because he's the only black man, he's an ex-con, and he works for a bunch of white women in the South, and and he is a great actor, it's a great character, he is funny, he gets, like, he has dignity, but he is also silly. Like, he's a very well-rounded character, so I'm not coming for Anthony. But it is also just, like, a little weird.
Yeah.
But he's working.
Yeah, the intro is easy to move on from.
Yeah, and I'm glad that...
once it gets to the plot of it, yeah.
Yeah, I'm glad that none of these are the actual plot. It's just, like, you're watching, like, oh, please don't spend the next 15 minutes talking about this.
Yeah. So don't have a conflict with your checkout person, please,
yes.
Charlene.
God. So the actual plot comes because Anthony is looking towards his friend Kendall Dobbs, who is played by the president from Scandal, Tony Goldwyn, right?
Yeah, the villain from Ghost.
Yeah. Well, that's also around this time.
Yeah,
was it 90?
3 years later, yeah.
Yeah, wow. So, hey, he's on the up and up. So he's helping out with, like, because he used to be, like, a DJ and stuff, and so, like, he's coming over, and, like, as soon as he mentions Kendall, all of the ladies light up. Like, he's an icon, he's a star, he helps them out all the time, even though we've never seen him before. They all just love him. And he also works at, like, a rival design firm, I think was the vibe I got. Like, he's at somewhere else because
he seems well off.
You know,
he comes in with, like, it's, like, very well put together. He's funding, well, we don't have to jump ahead, but, like, what he is there to talk to them about suggests a certain level of affluence, I guess.
Yeah, because he's establishing a permanent thing that will go on long after he, spoiler alert, passes. So he comes in, and basically he gets right to it, kind of. He's like, I'm here, actually, I want to talk to y'all about a special project. And then the gag of it all is, he says, his funeral. So, yeah. And then they're all like, Hal, you're so young. We found out later he's only 24, and it is because he has AIDS. So, how do you feel about this? Just so sad.
I mean, like I said earlier, the episode does kind of... It's such a lighthearted show that, like, to tackle an issue like this, they're putting themselves on the path to, you know, deal with a tricky balance. And
yes.
I think that it, for the most part, comes off well, especially for the time and especially for the lack of discussion for this in, like, mainstream shows like this at the time. It does feel like I didn't necessarily love Tony Goldwyn's performance. There was a little bit, like... And I'm sure some of that is, like, again, walking that tonal balance for what the show has to be. But there is, like, kind of an aw shucks element to it that it's like, okay, I get it. But, like, he just kind of flippantly says that he's dying.
Yeah, it's almost like he's going on vacation. There isn't a lot of... But I guess I... So that's again, like, I can't get in the mindset of, like, actually what it would be like, because it's clear, like, he's probably... Like, he's been thinking... He's known he's going to die soon for a while, so I'm wondering, like, if there was an acting choice of, like, well, he probably has thought about this all the time. He would not be crying right now. He would actually... It would be right. actually, at this point, be very... matter of fact, because it's just how he has to live every day. I did find out, again, by researching this, that apparently, and I don't know who this was, they actually cast an actor with AIDS to play this role, but when it came time to film, he was too sick.
Yeah.
And so they got Tony Goldwyn. And that, and I only found that in, like, a newspaper from 1987, and I don't know, like, what actor that was or anything. But, I mean, it was printed in 1987, so it has to be true. It's really, they dissolve to a kitchen chat, like, and there's no laughs. There are no jokes in this entire scene, which I think is the smart thing to do. And it's how this normally, like, very, like, sassy, snarky sitcom can get away with just having a, I don't know, 3 minute just talk about the truth about AIDS.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think one of the smart things that it does, and, like, again, this is just to the formula of the show and how it, the like, level of, like, what an 80s sitcom was like, and that it's not everybody has a story, but everybody's contributing to the conversation. Mm-hmm. And I think each of the women get to contribute. It can feel a little, like, forced, like they're trying to feed information to an audience that probably has a lot of misinformation a lot of bias. You know, it does feel incredibly mindful in that way, but it is really rewarding to see all of the characters kind of contributing to this conversation and all along the way affirming him as well.
Yeah. What I like about this is that, unlike a lot of other gay sitcom episodes, none of the four of them have to be convinced that he is not contagious or that he is wrong. Like, all four of them from the jump already know that you can only get AIDS through, like, blood transfusion, actual exchange of bodily fluids. You can't get it from holding hands. You can't get it. It's not airborne. Like, they already know that. And that was a very smart choice. I really, really appreciate that.
Mm-hmm.
They give Kendall the line of, you know, when I was at the hospital, like, on one side of me was a 65-year-old grandfather who got it from a blood transfusion, which now we know is personal. That is literally the story. And on the other side was, like, a teenager who got it from his boyfriend, who got it from a girl he was also sleeping with or something. Like, they do a good job of dispelling the rumors that it was a gay disease. It was the gay cancer, and it was only affecting gay people. And I think if you were younger, I think if you were born in, like, 2000, it probably doesn't hit you that Designing Women doing all this was definitely the first time that millions and millions of people heard this information.
Mm-hmm.
Because Ronald Reagan was not really didn't really care that much.
Didn't even say anything.
Yeah. Until 1985. So 2 years before this, but also, like, 5 years after it had started, you know, ravaging communities.
I think that's important context too for watching it with a modern audience, because it might feel like they're kind of dissipating its role in gay society, you know, that they are talking about other people that it affected, and they are really selling that point. And that's because of, you know, the context of what the conversation was, what people were told, you know. So it is actually important, and they're very mindful to include it, but I don't ever feel like, you know, how do I want to say this? I don't feel like it's ever trying to sell the audience on that and obscuring any of the gay stuff or diminishing or dehumanizing gay people with AIDS too, you know?
Because when they ask him, they're like, well, why do you want us to, he's like, I want y'all to plan my funeral. Y'all do such beautiful designs. I want y'all to, like, decorate it. And I want y'all to get, like, a jazz band to play this hymn. I'm, you know, from New Orleans, so I want that vibe. And then after I'm gone, the line, this funeral deals with a lot of, like, AIDS patients and people who do not have anything, and I want this to stay up after I'm gone, for future AIDS, like future funerals. Mm-hmm. And that it's just like so it's so heavy.
I was really struck by that too, because I mean, you look back in history in this era too, like people couldn't have funerals because funeral homes would refuse to serve them.
Mm-hmm.
And like it's a very like, that's one of the parts where I was like, maybe Tony Goldwyn is doing a good performance and that it's not too like flippant, because it's like it is a little bit more matter of fact, and like, but still like mindful. And it, at the time, you know, if people were in their communities paying attention, they would know what that means.
Yeah. And he also says that, like, he has to do all this because his parents are not happy with him. Like, he's not on speaking terms with his parents, which is, but he wants to take care of it because he doesn't want his parents to get saddled with the bill, which is, like, such a good son move. And I'm just, part of me, like, a vindictive, like, part of me is just like, let him pay for it.
Like, but, send you know, them the bill.
Send them the fucking bill. So they decide they are going to do it. And then that is the act break. So then we come back and we meet Mrs. Clifton, who is, she comes in with Anthony because Anthony went to go pick her up, and she tells this long story about how her seatbelt was hanging out of the car and it was sparking along the highway. So a cop pulled them over. It was like, you two are the weirdest couple I've ever seen. Like, it was just a weird aside.
I love her so much.
Yes. Well, and then she's, then they start talking about safe sex, and she says, like, oh, me and my husband always practiced safe sex, and it wasn't while it's cracked up to be. My sex was always in bed, and I was asleep, which is about as safe as it gets. And that's also, like, that ages interestingly. Good. Yeah.
Well, yeah. And she, then she's saying, is it to Charlene? She's like, if you need it, or it's to Mary Jo, I think, if you need advice on safe sex, come to me.
Yeah.
And it's just that that line alone coming out of her mouth is inherently funny.
The only, like, and I think that this might, that's definitely why she's in this episode, is because she is kind of a, like just like a doofy, sweet old lady, she can inject comedy into this episode that is a comedy dead zone. Because you cannot, it's like you can't get mad at her for making jokes because she's innocent. She doesn't know, like, she's just being herself, and therefore it is funny. And you're not like, how do we get Mary Jo to drop a zinger in this moment? Which would not work. But then, so Mary Jo has to go to a PTA meeting that night, and she goes, and this is where we meet this other, there are two villains in this episode.
There are two villains in this episode.
This sweater vest wearing uppity goon up there advocating that, like, the best way to avoid, like, STDs and whatever is abstinence, which is still a fucking talking point in the year
the
of our Lord 2021.
From a school today.
God, it is literally. And then, like, Mary Jo, who has just come from a guy that we know that she knows very well, even though we've never seen him before. She just found out he's dying because of a sexually transmitted disease, and she, like, speaks up. But then she actually, like, can't follow through. Like, she's nervous.
Yeah.
She has a character arc in this episode. Does she have the... she has the only character arc? Like, actual...
I mean, you could maybe say that Julia has one because of Imogene. But I mean, even that is just like, I'm minding my words around this woman. Okay, I'm gonna let her have it. Like, that's about as close to an arc as somebody else gets.
But, like, Mary Jo's point of view is so complicated because, like, she's kind of only half paying attention, and then after she, like, speaks up and then, like, just chickens out. I mean,
yeah, she gives that woman a modicum of pushback. She gives her just a tiny bit, and then everybody is like, yes, you go against her. Finally, someone will say something even, like, vaguely against this woman. And, like, she basically has to advocate for, it's not really specific what they're trying to get. Like, the woman who opposes her makes it seem like it's the school is funding condom dispensation throughout the, for all their students. But she never really says what it's for. Basically, it's teaching at least safe sex.
She sums it up because when Mary Jo gets nominated again, she's like half paying attention at this point because I think she's still rattled by Kendall's reveal. And after she gets nominated, she has no say. And she's just like, wait, what am I doing? What am I advocating for? And that's when Maleficent or whatever comes over and she's like, condoms for teenagers. Congratulations. And it's like, Jesus, I guess.
Yeah, she is kind of this actual snarling Southern PTA member.
Well, and like, again, the costuming, she's always like buttoned all the way up. She has like pilgrim bows at her, like under her neck. Like, she is sweater vest. She's clutch. If she had pearls on, she'd be clutching them. So
just
then
a fistful of pearls.
Yeah, just a fistful. Back at the Sugar Baker and Associates, this is where like Mary Jo, I was always trying to figure out like where Mary Jo actually stands. And I think it's kind of interesting that it isn't, she's nuanced. A lot of the characters on this show are very like, this is the real tea. And at first it seems like she's actually just really nervous about being a public speaker. Like, she's like, I don't know how to speak in public. Like, I don't want to do this. And then she's also like kind of like confused about where she stands on advocating for safe sex for teens.
Yeah. And like, she ultimately is very effacing about this, but I think being so close, we are told that she is to Kendall, gives her an avenue to like make it personal, to like also be able to understand why she would be advocating in that way. But yeah, she even is a little bit quieter in this kind of confrontation scene to Imogen.
Yeah, so she does say that she's now been nicknamed the Condom Queen, I guess, overnight. Like, I don't know how much time has passed since the PTA meeting last night and them today, but I mean, maybe she went out to like the drugstore and everyone there was like, yo, Condom Queen, go get her.
Yeah, this is like pre-Facebook PTA threads where, you know, people would be liking or disliking this woman being called Condom Queen. Yeah. Don't know who's calling her Condom Queen. Maybe the checkout person at the store said, hello, Condom Queen.
Kevin is always making those jokes.
Yeah.
And Kevin. I did. So then we also got like, Suzanne had a joke about how like, oh, that's one title I wouldn't even go out for because pageant queen, good joke. Charlene then tells a story about when she was a kid, she like found her dad's condoms and like blew them up like balloons.
On her birthday. Don't know why she was going through her dad's drawer, but they were there.
And then Suzanne has a really interesting monologue about how I think she's anti-sex because it messes up your hair and looks weird. Which is okay. Which I guess is like, this episode needed some jokes, so let's just give Suzanne just a take.
Yeah.
And there's the take. It's at this moment, though, that I noticed that back in the back, there's a ghoul reading some books back there. Imogen is in the background.
Yes.
Seated.
Why is she there? She's doing some type of business with Julia, but Julia doesn't even acknowledge her in the scene until we like see her back there.
It is very like, I don't even know how an interior design firm works. Do you always go over to the house and then you like hang out and like,
does it have to be in a house?
Yeah. And like, wait, so that is also where she lives. Is that literally her kitchen, that tiny little area of the living room?
She is us in quarantine. She works from home.
Yes, God. So Mary Jo is basically like, well, Julia, your nickname is the Terminator. Like, you speak in public. You are so eloquent. You like pick your words. You lose them. You use them like a machine gun. Can you please show me how it's done? She's like, well, I have to get mad about something, which is basically a loaded Julia, like loaded Chekhov's Julia is her saying, I have to get mad about something first. You know, it's coming. I did like that that Suzanne is angry about how women's lib means that men don't kill bugs for ladies anymore.
Yes, just in case any viewers at home were starting to feel uncomfortable with any progressiveness, she has to say that, you know, men should be men and kill bugs.
Yes. That's all the Reagan and Bush fans out there in 87 were like, hell yeah.
Yeah.
That's right. But
I'm a real man. I kill bugs.
Yes.
I don't let my wife kill no bugs.
For me.
I'm a real man.
Real men squash spiders. And then this is where Kendall, Charlene, like, takes his hand, and he brings up the fact that the hospital nurses didn't even want to touch him, which, coming after what Suzanne just said, is a sharp turn from funny into just titanically depressing.
Mm-hmm.
But that is when Imogen hears what's going on. And much like Jasmine Masters, she's got something to say.
Boy, does she ever. She is, I mean, like, this felt very true to this type of person. She is unabashed and unashamed to just throw her nastiness right into the ring and have no shame about it.
Yeah, I mean, this is the kind of thing that I don't like. It's the kind of thing that before 2020, I would have in the back of my mind had hope that even the worst of us would not be this bad. But after, like, hearing all the stories from people that I know of, like, getting physically assaulted for wearing masks in a Tennessee Target, it's like, oh, yeah, no, this is literally how a lot of assholes are, is
yeah.
They would, at a place of business that they are patronizing, say to another client, you deserve to die for being gay. Mm-hmm. This is God's punishment for you. You disgust me. Like, wow.
Yeah, I mean, like, it's, you know, because it's in a sitcom, you think it's potentially going to be this cartoonish character, but it's honestly very close to reality. Yeah. And the moment that it just hits is actually very smart writing, because you mentioned the hand-holding thing, which is obviously, like, this emotional beat for it, and then it almost immediately launches into that. So, yeah. Like, it invites us in the audience to, like, have this moment of connection and then be righteous with them when they take Imogen to task.
She says, like, you reap what you sow. She says the titular line, this disease is killing all the right people. And, like, I do like that all of, like, first, Suzanne stands up and she's like, if it's killing gay people, why does it affect lesbians so much less? And again, like any brainwashed, like in the deep end conservative whack job, she's, when confronted with logic, it's just like, well, Jesus said.
Yeah. She's like, well, I don't know anything about that.
No, but I am 100% certain that this is a disease specifically for that gay over there. And it's not good.
No.
So, we need to talk about Julia's interesting arc that happens right around this time. Because before, she says, her point of view before Imogen starts wilding out is that she's angry that Hollywood producers are now using AIDS and being afraid of AIDS as a reason to have characters resist being promiscuous in, like, movies and TV shows, when in mm-hmm. her opinion, it should be morality and classiness that keeps people from sleeping around. That's a take.
Yeah. That's the one that I was like, what is she arguing for here? She's saying that they should have already been doing, that characters should have already been more chaste or something.
It's an interesting kind of like
a different way to say it. There's a better way for her to have said that.
Usually when I watch episodes like these, I have in my head what I think characters are going to say when they start talking. And when she starts talking, it's like, Hollywood is now going to start using AIDS to scare people about gay people. It is like what mm-hmm. I was expecting her to say, but then she turns out to be like sex negative. Like she doesn't want, you know, sex before marriage, promiscuity. Like
she's like, it's good that they are sex negative in movies now, but not for this reason. But
yeah.
That's also not. She has this real backdoor way of saying it. That's not very confusing.
Yeah.
But she kind of comes around. I feel okay. So what does she actually say to Imogen? Because like they all get to contribute something,
yeah.
Which is what I like.
Yeah, because like even you know, they say like you can't, it's not airborne, you can't get it from touching, lesbians don't get it, so it isn't just affecting gay people. And then Julie, I wrote it down because it's just iconic. Like she's had it at this point when he says, or she says, I've known you for 27 years, and all I can say is, if God was giving out sexually transmitted diseases to people as a punishment for sinning, then you would be at the free clinic all the time.
The audience goes wild. It's amazing.
And then she adds, and so would the rest of us, which is a really good addition to that, I think. And it is kind of her quickly doing a 160.
<It's, Yeah. laughs>
Because she says that in response to AIDS is God's punishment for you gays. Like, that is the thing that then, like, sparks her, you know, gets her Terminator red eyes going. And she realizes, like, no, bitch, you sin all the fucking time. You are a lying, jealous, horrible monster. Let's go to town. And it's a good moment.
It was nice to hear the audience go so wild for Imogen being torn apart in the late 80s and hear the audience supporting it, even if it's canned and they have flashing signs telling them to cheer, whatever. It is very cathartic knowing what, like, the tenor of the general populace was towards AIDS, to hear an audience applaud this horrible woman being taken to task.
It's great, and especially compared to Cheers is the Boys in the Bar, which is, like, I think 4 years before this, and Diane has a lot of these Julia moments where she is, the script is very blunt in how Diane is like, hey, Cliff, Norm, Carla, you are being bigots. Like, she just thought, she calls them bigots. She basically says that they want to lynch gay people. Like, those are the lines that she says. And every time she says them, you can feel through the streaming service the air sucked out of that audience. Like, it is very, like, and I'm so glad that the show did that in 1983, like, to take that firm of a stance to call your own characters bigots is... And then, of course, they never address it again. But, you know, it's still great.
And she stayed friends with them.
Yes.
Because, you know, that's what we do
Our
friends that are homophobic. We just stay friends with them.
Cliff is closeted. That's my headcanon. John Ratzenberger would love that. And then even Mrs. Clifton gets a read in because, like, is it that she was responding to Imogen saying, like, you're not all there up here, like, in the head?
Yeah, and then she says, yeah, but you're not all there here, to
in
her chest.
Heart.
So, like, she's the one, I love that she's the one that gets to say, you don't have any humanity.
Yes.
You do not, you are a heartless ghoul.
Yeah.
because she, like you said, she's just this sweet old lady. So, like, her being in this episode feels very intentional to me, because she's the absolute right person to be able to look at that woman and say, you're a heartless piece of crap.
Yeah. Fuck off. Get out. And then she's like, well, I you know, take my business elsewhere. And Julia's like, bye, bitch. I don't want your business. Mm-hmm. And then she yells out after her that Payne, her son's name is Payne. Yeah, that's a very Southern name. She yells out, he's getting all A's, even in P.E. So she says she draws out P.E. in a weird way. Which,
you got the laugh. I mean, we should also maybe mention, and this felt, I was really grateful for this too, because, like, like we talked about, like, some of the criticisms in regards to other characters, it's an all white female cast basically having this argument, but they do still allow Kendall to speak up for this too. So, like, the trap is that this very easily could have been cis straight women talking about gay issues, you know, without with a gay person in the room who doesn't get to speak, but it avoids that, and I think that is commendable.
Which is the trap, which is the trap that all these episodes have, because there were no gay series regulars on a TV show before 1997. I mean, the closest you had, Martin Mull, Leon became a series regular in, like, the last season or two of Roseanne. So, like, but, like, it is rare, and it is it's a trap you always have, because the gay always comes in for a week and then is gone. And then we get resolution to our PTA scene. Also, I want to point out, on Hulu, these episodes are like 21 minutes. And I know when they aired, they were like 24. So there is like 3 minutes of this episode that...
At the beginning, it fades to black at one point and then comes back. Yeah. So I do think that they cut a chunk out.
Yeah, so I do want to know, like, what they took out. I have the DVDs, so maybe I should look at that. So then, we are now back at this debate, because they reconvened a week later because they wanted to get more appearance and to vote and stuff on whether or not they're going to make sure their kids don't die of STDs. And Mary Jo is doing all the right stuff. She's pointing out that this literally is not reality. It is not real that, no, like, you talking to your kids is going to stop them from doing anything. Then there's a gun control metaphor, which is also like, man, we are running out of time and you're getting into other stuff.
You're bringing up guns now, girl. It is like, what is the metaphor she used? She's like, she basically says, you can't take away the guns, so that's why we advocate for gun control.
Yeah.
Like, and like, that's what a condom is. Condoms are gun control. That's the takeaway from this episode.
It is, it's a lot to introduce at the very last minute. But then, like, I do hate that Mary Jo, even in her ultimately progressive stance of, like, we need to provide teenagers with the means to protect themselves, but she still has to say, you know, I'm all for abstinence, and obviously that is the, like, best solution is to not even have sex, but we can't pretend that that's not, that that's, you know, the way it's going to really mm-hmm. be. And I hate that we still even have to couch the truth under the veil of, like, but I mean, abstinence obviously is the best.
Yeah.
But no, I hate that.
And it did actually feel that way. It didn't feel like she was, you know, manipulating the room in a way, because that could have also been a valuable, like, tactic. But it truly felt genuine of that's, you know.
Well, yeah, which is
what
indicative of her arc and why she was, like, so hesitant at first. And, like, basically, she's like a person who's never been called on to take a firm stance on this. And now mm-hmm. all of a sudden she has to take firm stances on it in, like, two plot lines in a sitcom episode. And Mary Jo uses Kendall as an example in a speech without naming him, which I thank you Mary Jo for not being like my gay friend over there in the back watching this PTA meeting.
Yeah. Kindly showed up for my meeting. He's in the back of the class. He's the one with the curly blonde hair.
Yeah.
That's my friend. That is my gay friend. No, it's not like that.
Yeah, it's just like I know someone who has. And I do like that she says condoms are not just about preventing births or about preventing deaths. And then she says, like, you know, our kids are going to make horrible mistakes and, like, they're going to, like, screw up and whatnot, but I don't think they should have to die for it, which is great.
Yeah.
And that's really what it is. You shouldn't have to die for having sex.
Yeah. It is a fine line that the episode walks really well, because you also don't want Kendall to just be a device for her to get what she wants, you know? And I think it does avoid doing that, and does it without, you know, shaming him or, you know, putting it in a way like he did something bad. Like, no, it's not.
No,
like
they're
that.
Very even like still the vibe of the whole thing is like basically the thesis statement of the episode is AIDS is not a punishment. Period. Like, it is not a punishment. It is not a punishment for sinning. It is not a punishment for gay people. It's not a punishment for having sex. It is a disease. Which is, I mean, that was definitely the vibe at the time. And, I mean, the vibe today in still certain areas. Mm-hmm. And then we get the last scene of the episode, which is, oh, God, like, fade to black, fade back up on a casket with a beautiful jazz band playing that hymn that I can't remember the name of, and then panning over, and there are our designing women surrounded by a bunch of men with mustaches. And I mean, like, yeah.
He got his New Orleans jazz band.
Yeah, and it's like, oh, the episode, he's dead. The episode ends, like, yep. And, yeah, it's an ending.
I mean, like, it could have really been, I feel like I'm just like, it could have been the worst version of what it sounds like, but it's not like on every beat in this episode, but truly this ending could have been this kind of,
test run,
like maudlin grotesque thing. But I do think it actually ends really gracefully and sweet. And, in some ways does feel like, I mean, fantasy sounds like a harsh word, but like we know that so many people didn't get to have that, you know, didn't get to have anything at all. And what a tragedy that is, that, you know, I think it kind of presents a vision to an audience, perhaps also one that is trying to open their hearts and minds, of what people could have that they're being denied, the dignity ripped from them.
It is very sad and heartbreaking and like very, I mean, it's very merciless in a way. It's just like, this is the truth, but it is also so beautiful, dignified for a character that we just met, you know, 18 minutes ago. It does feel very powerful, dignified, as I keep saying, and celebratory, cathartic, especially seeing all of those men. And I mean, like, I have a mustache because I am gay. I don't have a mustache because my dad always had one. I have one because I'm a gay man. And it's a weird little token thing, but it is, it connects me to my, you know, gay forefathers, these men in 1987 who, I mean, do you think that all those extras might have been actual gay men? Like, I mean, I feel like maybe.
I mean, because if the show had enough intention that they initially were trying to get a gay actor for Kendall, I would believe it.
God, I would like to know where all those men are now. And so, God, this is one of those like, how much of a therapy session do we want this to get into?
Well, you know, I mean, if anything, it's like this episode, as we've kind of talked about, has, you know, that balance of not even bittersweet, but just the truth. Like you said, this is how it is. While still, you know, giving a satisfying episode that probably, you know, I can really imagine, you know, the audience for this show, because even a lot of liberal people at the time did not do right by history in terms of AIDS. It could have had its impact.
Good for Designing Women. Are you ready for some must-have facts about this episode?
Yes, please. Lay them on me.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Okay, so in terms of how many people actually watched this episode, 16.5 million people watched this episode of Designing Women that is all about AIDS. That is a huge number.
When the president of the United States was refusing to even say the word AIDS, 16 million people getting this story is significant.
from Designing Women. Well, and it was also 11th for the week. And I think that it was up from 23 the previous week. So a lot more people tuned in for this episode, which I think is great. The top five shows that week were number five, Moonlighting. Number four, Who's the Boss? Number three, Growing Pains. Two, Murder, She Wrote, and number one, The Cosby Show. What do you think about those top five shows? Any strong feelings?
Much love to Murder, She Wrote.
Number two! That was
amazing. Amazing. Yeah.
Good for Jessica Fletcher.
Yes, I mean, all respect to Jessica Fletcher's name and legacy.
So this episode aired as part of CBS's iconic Monday Night lineup, the 1987 iteration. So this is pre-Murphy Brown. The lineup at that time was Frank's Place, followed by Kate and Allie, then Newhart, Designing Women, and then Cagney and Lacey. So, you know, there's a lot of gay stuff going on that night. I mean, Kate and Allie, Cagney and Lacey, lots of, like, ladies together. Having fun.
Monday night is for the ladies.
Were you a CBS Monday night kid, or were you a Thursday night NBC or Friday night ABC?
I went through such stages. I mean, I was probably like an every single day syndication kid more mm-hmm. than I was anything in actual prime time. It took me probably until high school, and it, to my great shame, it's probably that I was more of a Fox American Idol kid. I apologize. Please know that I have changed. I have grown. I have, you know, I've done all of that. I've had retribution. And then, I mean, like, my high school days were like the beginning of Project Runway.
Yeah.
So, like, a lot of my, like, must watch stuff in certainly in prime time, like as it was airing, was a lot of reality TV.
Well, and also like early 2000s are a garbage time for sitcoms. I'll just get out there and say it. So I mean, I was coming of age.
It's also like coming off of the time when a lot of the big shows were ending, right?
Yeah, and I mean, like Frasier and Friends are in their last stretch. Will and Grace is in its last stretch. Seinfeld ended in 99, so like, or 98. So a lot of things are ending. I mean, yeah, my high school and middle school time was, what, 98 to 2002, so pretty peak. And then I was also obsessed with News Radio and Third Rock from the Sun in middle school.
Which I watched those in syndication.
I mean, yeah, I was obsessed with my, like, nightly TV. I had my schedule. I when I got a computer, I got Microsoft Paint and I recreated all the logos of all the shows.
That's amazing.
I'm a nut job. So this was, of course, nominated for a writing Emmy. Did not win. I did not look up what beat it, but I imagine it definitely was not better than this episode. And now, yeah, so Joyce Millman from the San Francisco Examiner is who I've been quoting this entire time. She wrote in her, like, preview piece for this. This episode carefully debunks myths. The women embrace Kendall and hold his hand and urges safe sex. And then she adds, in a departure from the show's usual heavy-handed tear-jerking, the episode takes its lead from the dry-eyed Kendall and maintains an uplifting tone of resolve. Accurate. That's basically what we said.
Yeah.
Joyce Millman, we're on the same wavelength here.
We agree, Joyce.
Yeah. On IMDb, 136 designing women fans rated this a 9.3 out of 10. Do you think that's too high? Is it accurate? Is it right on the money? What would you say?
That's pretty good. I mean, especially for this show, I think this is one of the more, like, discussed and iconic episodes. It's a really satisfying episode. Yeah, I would go with that. That's cool.
Yeah, I would give it, yeah, I think a 9. A good 0.3.
We don't do decimals here. we'll go with just a solid 9. Good TV.
Who would you say had the must-see performance in this episode?
I mean, it's... well, I mean, I just... I love Alice Gosley so much. I mean, it's got to be Dixie Carter, right? She gets the lines that really get to rile up the crowd. I mean...
Yeah.
Knowing that Dixie Carter was also on the conservative side,
yes,
too, you know, if you kind of look at it through that lens, which, like, especially because everything's in hindsight now with this show, you know, it almost makes it a little bit more satisfying to believe that, you know, she was, she did believe the things that Julia was saying. Maybe that's me just wishful thinking. But yeah, I mean, she definitely gets the, like, showiest stuff. Like, Jean Smart has, like, two punchlines. Delta Burke doesn't really even say that much.
I'll give it to Mary Jill. I'll give it to Annie Potts, just because I really do like the nuanced, kind of, like, in a daze, in over her head, kind of, like, rising to the occasion arc she has.
Mm-hmm.
Which I think is very satisfying as well. But, like, both of them are great. Lastly, must other people see this episode of television?
Absolutely.
Yes. This is especially... Okay, kids, gather round. Seriously, watch. I mean, like, I do think that this episode, for being a filmed in front of a live studio audience, multi-camera sitcom, filmed on tape, not on film, I think. I might have just put my foot in my mouth. Yeah, it is all that, but it is also, like, such a good time capsule of, like, a sitcom needed to say all of this stuff without obfuscation via punchline. It had to just say, you cannot get AIDS via air. Like,
yeah.
Because no one else was. And I think that, like, you know, I think you're very aware of how on a tear I am with preaching gay history literally all the time.
And I'm right there with you.
Because, like, it is... just to paraphrase RuPaul, it's like, as gay people, we got to tell our history. Because again, schools aren't teaching this. If you're in Tennessee, they're trying to actually make it illegal to just teach gay history without warning parents first and giving them a month to pull their kids out of the lesson if they object. So it is upon everyone to learn your history. And obviously, like, watching current things, like It's a Sin is great, and maybe does a better job of showing what it was like.
Well, I mean, we have, you know, a show today can learn from certain mistakes, or, yes, you know, contextualize itself in a way that it doesn't have to walk as fine of a line as this episode of Designing Women did, because no one else was having these type of conversations.
So I think that, like, definitely watch this, and basically every single streaming service has a gay history documentary. They all launch with one now. It is part of the streaming service launch pack. So go watch any of those. But yeah, this is the kickoff to Pridebuff. I'm glad that it wasn't cathartically angry as I was worried it might get when I start talking about this stuff.
Yeah, got a whole month.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I don't know what other episodes I'm covering, so, like, who knows? It could still happen. It's just a lot. It's just a lot. Where can people find you on the internet if they want to talk about all things gay?
Definitely, I am only ever talking about all things gay. You can find me on Twitter and Letterboxd at Chris V File. That is F-E-I-L. You can follow my podcast, This Had Oscar Buzz. We are also on Twitter at @Had_Oscar_Buzz.
Excellent day. And that does it for this episode of Must Have Seen TV. Thanks again to my guest, Chris File, for dropping by and talking about Designing Women with me. Next time I'll be discussing hold on to your butts. It's gonna be a whole month of gay stuff. I'm planning ahead, which is why I don't know what it's gonna be yet, but there's some good stuff coming. Until then, I want to hear from all of you. Follow Must Have Seen TV on Twitter and Instagram, and let's talk about sitcoms. And if you have any Hayden Rourke questions for my Q&A, email musthaveseentv@gmail.com or just at me on Twitter. Rate and review the show in Apple Podcasts, because again, I need validation. Please follow me on Twitter and Instagram at Brett White. Revalidation. Read the words that are at decider.com, including pieces about designing women and Golden Girls being gay icons. Thanks to Acast for hosting this gay nonsense, and thanks to all y'all for listening, and I will see y'all next time on Must Have Seen TV.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.